You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jake Carlisle-Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to a reporter who visited one of the three clinics in Wisconsin providing abortion services. She'll share how patients and doctors are navigating the state's abortion laws.
First, Senate Republicans released their proposal for changes to the federal tax system on Thursday. The Senate bill differs significantly from the House bill, which was released earlier this month. The nonpartisan Joint Committee on Taxation said the Senate version does more to cut taxes on middle-class Americans than the House version.
Henry Aaron is the former director and now senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Program in Economic Studies. He's back with us for a look at the Senate tax overhaul bill. Hank, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into some of the particulars, big picture, how significant are the differences between the Senate version and the House version?
Let's focus on certain similarities. The biggest similarity is that both would cost about $1.5 trillion over the next 10 years in lost revenue net. There are some big tax raisers and some bigger tax losers in both bills. They differ in character. From the standpoint of individuals, I think the two biggest differences are that the House bill completely eliminates the deductions for medical expenses. The Senate bill doesn't. In contrast, the Senate bill gets rid of all of the deductions for state and local taxes. The House bill gets rid of some of them and limits others. Those are the two biggest differences at the personal level. There's been some focus on the difference in the number of rates, three or four in the House bill and seven in the Senate. That's really quite unimportant because, as you know and I know, most of us now do our tax returns either with canned programs that we do on our home computer or we go to an accountant to have them done. So the number of brackets is really quite unimportant and has nothing much to do with tax simplification.
Now, there's been talk of doubling the personal deduction. Excuse me. And if that happens, does it make those other changes you mentioned less relevant? If we're not itemizing our taxes, does it matter what happens to things like the local taxes deduction?
You're absolutely right. It's the doubling of the standard deduction in the House bill and also a similar increase in the Senate. That means that many fewer people will itemize their deductions, but it still leaves a great many people who will be doing that, especially in the relatively high tax states. Property taxes are quite high, for example, in New England. Income taxes are high on both coasts. So a lot of people in different states will continue to itemize, fewer than under current law. And that is, in fact, significant simplification because the need to itemize deductions is a source of complexity at the individual level.
And we mentioned the Joint Committee on Taxation saying that the Senate version would ultimately be better as it stands for middle-class taxpayers in the House version. That's something that Republicans have been shooting for or talking about, at least as we enter this process. Do you agree with that assessment?
I agree with it, but I think it's only a small proportion of the distributional story. Much the larger part of the distributional story is that under both bills, the principal benefits accrue to people with relatively high incomes, in no small measure because of changes in the treatment of businesses and how they would be taxed. Businesses are mostly owned by people who are relatively highly taxed and have relatively high incomes, and they would stand to gain most from the business tax deductions.
We're talking to Hank Aaron from the Brookings Institution, looking at the Senate tax overhaul bill, comparing and contrasting it with what came out from House Republicans a little earlier. Let's stay on the topic of business taxation. There were efforts in both the House and the Senate aimed at trying to keep money from going to lower tax jurisdictions elsewhere in the world, leaving the United States and having income not taxed here in the United States. What is the Senate trying to do to that end?
That is the rhetoric that's associated with the tax discussion. But both bills would go to a principle called territorial taxation, in which the United States would tax income earned here in the United States, but it would either not tax or tax very much more lightly income even of U.S.-owned corporations from operations they carry out overseas. It would reduce the taxes on overseas operations. Now, under current law, the tax is such that many businesses, so to speak, keep their profits overseas. But in fact, as one of my colleagues here at Brookings has pointed out, businesses do have access to those overseas earnings under current law. They can borrow against them, and there are various other transactions by which they can make use of those funds. So it isn't clear to me that these reforms are going to do much to keep investment here at home. It will remain the case that U.S.-owned corporations stand to gain a good deal from carrying out operations overseas.
And let's look at the corporate tax rate. Both the House and the Senate would drop the corporate tax rate to 20% from 35%. The Senate would do it just more slowly, it sounds like, to pay off some of the other cuts they have, it sounds like. Is that a significant difference?
In the long run, it isn't. The timing makes a big difference in the scoring of how much revenue is lost through a particular provision. Remember that there are rules under which the Senate operates, the most important of which for this purpose is called the Byrd Rule, named after Senator Byrd from West Virginia. And it imposes some very tough requirements that are going to bulk large in the debate as it unfolds. Specifically, the Byrd Rule bars any piece of legislation from cutting revenues outside the 10-year budget window that is used for scoring these bills if the bill is to be can be passed by a simple majority. If the Senate parliamentarian concludes that revenues are lost beyond the 10-year budget window as a result of this bill, then it would take 60 votes to pass it. And that would reduce the likelihood that the bill actually could be passed. In fact, I think it would reduce it very close to zero. So there is a real challenge as to how to write the bill in a way that doesn't lose revenue outside the budget window. Back in the George W. Bush administration, Congress did that by simply saying, oh, well, the bill is going to expire at the end of the 10-year window, so it doesn't have any effect outside of that period. As it turned out, much of it did expire, but not all. Congress renewed some of it, but not all of it. So there's going to be a big fight over how the law or how the bill is written, and that's going to influence the specific provisions that remain in it and hence the politics that play out around this bill.
When the House plan came out and we talked to you, you said there were, in effect, a lot of tricks or gimmicks in the bill in part to meet those requirements. Do you see that in the Senate bill as well?
There's some of that as well here. There's one area, for example, where the Senate is not using a gimmick that the House did, for example, with respect to the estate and gift tax, which the House bill had expiring, but only at the very end of the budget window. That in itself would have cost revenue outside of the 10-year period, and it would have contributed to a question about whether the bill could be passed, the House bill could be passed in the Senate by just a simple majority rather than requiring 60 votes to stop a filibuster. The Senate bill is more straightforward in this respect, with respect to the estate tax. It simply says that a couple can have more than $20 million in assets rather than just more than $10 million in assets before the estate tax begins to bite. But that starts right away and it continues indefinitely.
As we wrap up, Hank, what is the next step now?
The next step is for each house to try and pass a bill within each different body. They want to do that as quickly as possible. At that point, the usual procedure is to appoint a conference committee with representatives from both houses. They then iron out the differences, come to agreement on a single bill that would then go back to both houses. The two houses would have to pass the same bill, and if they succeed in doing so, it then goes to the president's desk. There is a good chance that the House can pass a bill because the Republicans who are supporting this effort enjoy a much larger majority there than in the Senate, and there are not enough obvious dissenters at this point. The Republicans have only a two-vote margin in the Senate, and one member who has declared his opposition pretty much already, so that makes it very close in the Senate. So the battle is going to go on within each House, but even if each one passes the bill, there remains the very difficult task of ironing out disagreements and then passing it yet again through both houses of Congress. So stay tuned. If I were a betting person, I don't think I would put a lot of money on the success of this effort in the end, other than perhaps some modest rate reductions, which could be quite popular in both houses. But the full range is going to be very difficult to do.
Hank, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Henry Aaron, former director, now senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Program in Economic Studies. He joined us for a look at the Senate tax proposal.
First, laws regarding abortion in Wisconsin have become more restrictive in recent years. In 2013, Governor Walker signed a bill into law requiring women to have an ultrasound before undergoing an abortion. And in 2015, he approved a 20-week abortion ban in the state.
To check up on those changes, our next guest talked to those directly affected by the issue. In addition to talking with lawmakers on both sides of the debate, she visited with patients and doctors at one of the three facilities in the state that offer abortion services.
Jesse Poyen covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. Her recent cover story for the paper is called Inside Planned Parenthood. Jesse, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So what led you to visit Planned Parenthood for your story and to take a really patient-focused look at abortions in the state?
Yeah, well, a few months ago, I did a story looking at, I write about these laws and these policies quite a bit. Anytime a new one's introduced, anytime, you know, there's any sort of debate about it, I write about them. And it's usually from the perspective of whatever the legislative debate is on the floor. So a few months ago, I did a story kind of looking at some of the effects of these laws over the years in a cumulative fashion. But I felt like it was still a little bit more politics focused. And so I wanted to take a look at this from a more practical focus and see, you know, how are these laws actually being implemented? What was the intention when they were introduced and passed? Are they serving the intended purpose? And how are they affecting the way that this service is provided?
So I want to get to what the patients that you did talk to said. But, you know, in your piece, it says that they did not all of the people you talked to were seeking an abortion. They were just using Planned Parenthood services. And you spoke to, I believe, 7 people. You know, did they have some, you know, hesitation talking to you about this?
You know, I'm really surprised. I'm still surprised by how many women were really willing to let me do this. I can't imagine letting a reporter sit in on an annual physical with me. So I was surprised that so many were willing to do it. You know, we just kind of approached it patient by patient, and it was the majority who were there seeking abortion services. It was just one woman who wanted to get an ultrasound there. But yeah, you know, some of them I talked to and went through kind of the whole process from the beginning. And some of them I actually ended up talking to because they were frustrated when they were talking to the nurse that was with them. And the nurse asked, well, you know, we have a reporter who's in the office today if you'd like to talk to her. And some of the women in the story were just so frustrated during the process that they wanted to talk to me since I was there.
Can you just expand a little on what some of their frustrations were?
Yeah. You know, the accumulation of all of these laws is it sort of impacts your visit at every aspect of it. So, you know, the ultrasound requirement is one thing that you know, is part of, you know, you may expect it in medicine, but there's, you're being told, you know, you have to do this because of the state law. So it's not just that you have to have an ultrasound, but you're going to have the image on the screen described to you and have the screen turned toward you. So some women were not necessarily bothered by that individually, but kind of questioned why it had to happen that way. And then, you know, the other aspects of it are just there are things that a doctor will go over with the patient when they talk about the risks of the procedure, as they would with any medical procedure. And the doctors kind of make a point to make clear what they're telling patients because they think that it's medically accurate and medically necessary, and what they're telling patients because state law requires them to, but they may disagree with it. And usually it was at that point that some of the women were frustrated and wondering, you know, why do you have to tell me this, and what is that law, and, you know, why does that affect this? One thing in particular that one woman was confused about was one of the more recent laws requires the doctors to tell women the probable post-fertilization age of the fetus as opposed to the gestational age. You know, it's something that the doctors wouldn't have done if not for the state law. And so that was something that just, you know, kind of another question for the patients who were there.
So can you really quickly clarify what the difference between those two things are?
Yeah. So the gestational age is how doctors generally measure pregnancies based on the last period. The probable post-fertilization age is tied more toward when conception actually occurred, and that's not something that doctors tend to measure in obstetrics, but it is something that is often referred to when we look at laws like the 20-week bans on abortion. Those are usually tied to probable post-fertilization, which is usually a little bit earlier than the gestational age.
Sure, and thanks for clarifying that, Jesse. And I want to remind our listeners that we're talking to Jesse O'Poyan. She covers state government and politics for the Capital Times. She had a recent cover story in the Cap Times called Inside Planned Parenthood, where she spoke with patients and doctors about, you know, trying to navigate the abortion laws in Wisconsin. And so, Jesse, there are two pretty big criteria in the state. One, which you just mentioned, which is that the state bans abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. And then there's also the fact that women have to go and visit the doctor twice. So how does, you know, those sort of laws are pretty time sensitive. So how does that impact access for women in the state?
Yeah, you know, the 20-week one definitely has, just from a numbers perspective, it's going to impact fewer women just because abortions at that stage of a pregnancy are pretty rare. It's usually when there's some sort of fetal anomaly or some sort of illness that becomes a risk. But when we look at things like the requirement to return to the same doctor, visit multiple times, you know, that starts to become a little bit more complicated for women who are coming from out of town, usually. So there's two different procedures or different ways to have an abortion. You can have the in-clinic suction procedure, or you can take a medication. The thing with the medication now is that you have to return and see the original physician that you had your first appointment with. So that starts to get complicated for women who are usually coming in pretty early in their pregnancy, but they may have to wait a few weeks later. The rate of effectiveness goes down at that point. It's obviously, you know, when you're scheduling any procedure, any doctor's visit, just trying to time out scheduling with your schedule can be a problem if you've got work or you've got childcare to worry about. You know, I think something that people don't think about often is that, you know, a lot of women who are having abortions do already have children, and they are dealing with childcare for the children they already have. So things like that all come into play. It results in people making a couple different visits, sometimes driving multiple hours in order to do that. Of course, the people who pass those laws will say they really want to make sure that women are thinking this through, that they're given every single option, that they're aware of all of those options, that maybe there's a chance to persuade a woman to make a different choice before she ultimately gets to that point.
And, you know, part of this big conversation is that this is policy playing out in everyday lives. And you spoke with people on both sides of this debate. And I don't want to downplay the fact that, you know, this is still a conversation that many people, you know, have really passionate views and opinions on. So let's start with, you know, the lawmakers that have put this in place. You know, what has been, you got into a little bit of their rationale as to why they wanted to pursue this, but, you know, what's really guiding them in the legislature?
Yeah, I mean, this is, as everyone knows, this is an incredibly difficult issue because I think most people who have a strong opinion on it are not likely to be swayed, no matter how the conversation goes. And that's what it ultimately comes down to in a lot of the debate, is it's just two sides that aren't going to see eye to eye on it. But the lawmakers who have authored these laws, or the groups that have promoted them, you know, ultimately, they'll tell you what they want to see is fewer abortions. And we should note, you know, that Wisconsin has seen fewer abortions. It's declined about 23% the rate here since 2010. So they point to that as a sign of success. They say, you know, we're making policy changes and we're having a conversation that's making people think about what all of their options are, that's guiding them in the direction of, you know, ultimately carrying that pregnancy to term, whether they're keeping the baby or they're giving it up for adoption. But that's, you know, that seems to be sort of the end goal. You get into specifics on some of these laws. I think we've heard more of this in other states and other debates where, you know, there's discussion of, you know, just trying to offer medically accurate information. And that's another element of it. But I think the end goal is that the people who are promoting these laws and passing them want to see fewer abortions.
Jesse, we'll have to leave it there for right now. Jesse, thank you so much for joining us. Jesse Opoyan is a state government reporter for the Capital Times. She was with us to talk about how Wisconsin's abortion laws are affecting patients and doctors at the state's Planned Parenthood clinics.
Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time.
First, recent mass shootings have prompted many to wonder how to prevent mass violence. Our next guest is part of a team at the University of Wisconsin-Madison that works to stop violence on campus before it happens.
Chris Cole is the director of Threat Intervention Services at the UW-Madison Police Department and a former FBI agent. He's in the studio with us to talk about what threat assessment is and how people can use it in their everyday lives. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, you do this thing called threat assessment. You did it for the FBI. You do it at UW-Madison. What do we mean by threat assessment?
You know, after we have a mass shooting or similar event, we'll often hear how this person just snapped. And that's rarely the case. And there's a pretty distinct pathway that most of these individuals follow. And they kind of throw off warning signs along the way. With threat assessment, we try and recognize those warning signs and intervene before the event occurs.
And, yeah, you say no one just snaps. And I think so often after the mass shootings that we've seen lately, there's almost this idea that it's this force of nature. It's a thing that happens. It's like an earthquake. Nobody could have done anything about it. And you're really trying to change our thinking on that.
Absolutely. You know, we talk about this pathway that someone follows, and it really almost always begins with a grievance. And when we're looking at this grievance, it's important to look at it through the eyes of the person holding it. And for most of us, a lot of these things are trivial, things we just blow off. But for them, it becomes an obsession.
Yeah, we'll go up that pathway, starting at grievance, in just a bit. But first, is this profiling? I think people might say, is this like the profiler on the TV that we see, where we look at these demographic factors and we know who is likely to commit a crime?
No, it's not. And quite frankly, there's really no reliable demographic factor when we're looking at cases like this. It's really behavioral based.
So somebody has this grievance, and then a lot of people have grievances in their daily lives. Probably everybody has something. What is it that starts to separate someone who might be a potential threat? What do they take with that grievance, and where do they go from there?
Well, again, after this grievance, the first stage is this ideation. And that's sort of where they become good with violence being a way to handle it. In fact, it then goes into violence as being almost the only way to address this grievance.
And what kind of warning signs can people around them see? Because I think that's what we're really concerned about, people around them or maybe even the authorities. What kind of red flags are there that this isn't just an angry person, this is an angry person that might take violent action?
You know, first thing we tell people is trust their instincts, trust their intuition, because there's really no better judge of one's surroundings than one living in that environment. So first, that's the first thing. And obviously, if somebody's got some concerns, we're going to want to flesh out why they have those concerns. What's the factual basis for why they feel that way?
And you're looking at this from the perspective of a university campus. People might be doing this from a workplace or a local government. There could be a lot of institutions. What do you do on that institutional level to watch for red flags, to collect them, and to gather that kind of information?
You know, first, it's good communication on campus, both within the student population and with our employees also. And again, just have a sense of awareness as far as what's going on about them. And then there are some specific things, you know, as far as looking for. It's kind of a change in energy or tone. And that can really go in both directions, really an increase, you know, almost a hyper sense of, you know, of what's going on. And it could also go the opposite direction. When somebody's sort of checked out, it's also a concern.
I think people might be reluctant to say something to, say, a police department on a campus or in a town, thinking, what if I'm just reading this wrong? Maybe this is just kind of a weird person. I don't want them to get arrested based on my idle suspicion.
Well, you really, no one's going to get arrested. And, you know, the fact of most of these cases, there really isn't a crime hasn't been committed until the plan is fairly far along, and quite often until it's actually occurred. This is much more of a intervening and redirecting versus prosecuting.
Right. So how would you do that if there was someone who looked like they were partway along that pathway? So you got a tip from a student or faculty member or something like that. You looked at their communications, said, yeah, this looks kind of bad. Like, what's in your toolkit at that point?
You know, there's a couple of different things. It's about redirecting them. There's mental health services. There's, you know, what's going on with their lives. You know, and we go through this assessment process. We sort of look at what we call enhancers, things that are likely to make them act out, and also mitigators. And, you know, what's going on in their life career-wise, family-wise, support system, and what can we do to build up those mitigators?
Talking to Chris Cole, Director of Threat Intervention Services at UW-Madison and former FBI agent, looking at the idea of threat assessment to prevent acts of violence. Now, just recently we saw in the news there was the horrible, of course, Sandy Hook shooting back in 2012. Some of those files came out in the reports that came out after that, and there were reports about the shooter as much as 4 years earlier talking specifically about wanting to shoot up that particular elementary school. And again, with that idea that we think somebody just snaps, that's a sign of people might think about this for weeks, even years, before committing an act like this.
That's correct. And with the Sandy Hook shooting, again, the warning signs were there. And it sounds like they were recognized and reported. And there's a follow-up that has to go on. And threats, their assessments, they're managed. And for law enforcement, that's kind of a change in how we approach things. In my time in the FBI prior to 9/11 was very much about something would happen, investigate, and hold the person or individuals responsible for who did it. After 9/11, it was much more how do we get ahead of threats? How do we act proactively? And for law enforcement, that's kind of a change of how we view things. You know, we tend to be wired to like a beginning, a middle, and an end. And as threat assessment and management, it's much more about managing that threat, ebbs and flows. And quite often, it's over a long period of time.
Some people might hear this and think, maybe feel a little funny about the idea that, okay, someone hasn't committed a crime, so why should they get enhanced attention from the police or other authorities?
And that's a good question. First, there has to be some sort of a predication to get involved. And for us, it's a reasonable belief that a person could poses a threat. And again, it's much more of a initially a soft intervention approach. And the way these things turn out, these bashes, they don't turn out very well for the shooter or the shooter's family generally either. So again, it's much more of an intervention and a redirection.
And talk about some of the predictors. People talk a lot about domestic violence, a history of domestic violence being a predictor of future violence. Is that something you look at when you're making a threat assessment?
Yeah, there are. There are certain, again, these warning behaviors, and touched a little bit on that pathway behavior, which is that ideation, planning, preparation, and the attack. And then there's also some other, there's fixation type behavior. That's where, you know, this fixation, undue fixation, stalking type behavior. Something called novel aggression. That's the behavior, there's such a thing as a minor violent act to kind of get good with committing the bigger planned attack. And those are, again, some of the behaviors we look for.
Now, you do this, again, for UW-Madison. Most people listening probably work maybe for a smaller business or even a bigger business. They don't have their own, I imagine, threat assessment officer. So for somebody in that situation, when they see something, threats that regularly come in from a person, some of the behaviors you're talking about, what do they do?
Well, contact their human resources office. And here at UW and in most places, Office of Human Resources are really, really becoming more tuned in to work preventing violence in the workplace. There's a organization I belong to, the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals, and it's law enforcement, human resources, mental health, educational professionals. And every year we have in excess of 700 people attend our annual meeting. So again, threat assessment is something that human resources definitely tuned into, and some would definitely want to let them know if they had some concerns.
And let's talk about particular incidents that an organization like the ones I was mentioning would want to think about. So they've got maybe an employee that has raised concerns, and that person is then fired from the job. Is that a time where an organization should be taking extra careful steps?
Absolutely. And one of the phrases we use is separation does not equal security. And absolutely, be it a school, be it a business, there are times when that relationship has to end. But once that happens, we have to understand that, you know, the ability to observe on a daily basis, and quite frankly, the ability to influence behavior, both those goes away. So not saying that there aren't times to sever relationships, but we need to have a plan for what happens next.
We're talking to Chris Cole, Director of Threat Intervention Services at the UW-Madison Police Department. We're looking at threat assessment.
And you can join the conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think about this idea of threat assessment? What questions do you have for our expert? And does your workplace have an emergency plan? And what makes you feel safe or not at your job? You can call in now at 800-642-1234. Again, that number is 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. We're picking up our discussion now about threat assessment with Chris Cole. He's the Director of Threat Intervention Services at the UW-Madison Police Department.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about this idea of threat assessment? How does your workplace handle the potential for violence? Do you feel safe at work? If you work at a university or school, have you been trained to react to an incident of violence? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas at WPR.org. To your calls now, Lisa is with us in Janesville. Lisa, hi.
Hi. I'm just calling with my experience. Our family just moved back from England. And while living in England, I worked in the school system, and all school personnel were trained in threat assessment, and it's very much what your guest was saying. It was based on behavior. There wasn't profiling. And the advantage that was also seen as being in the school system is oftentimes children will say things that can alert personnel to something that may be happening in the family, and often mental health services was involved. It was, as he was saying, soft-level intervention to try to prevent a crisis. And we did see cases where there was significant benefit, and we did prevent something possibly awful from happening.
Lisa, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that experience. And Chris, the idea of having that training in place, maybe a point of contact for everybody who works in that school in this case.
Oh, absolutely. And particularly with incidents at schools, Secret Service and Department of Education did a study on this, and kind of telling is that school attackers, 60% former or current students, 11% former current employees, 20% with a indirect affiliation. Those are going to be generally domestic violence cases that find their way onto campus. So the takeaway on that is threats to schools, it's going to be somebody we know.
Lisa, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your experience there. Dennis is with us now in New Auburn. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Hey, a question that I had is just kind of what I've noticed is a lot of these people that create these tragedies seems like they start off as abusers of their wife or abusers of children. It seems like that's kind of a starting point for them, or it seems like they all have that in common. Do you see that in your studies there?
Yeah, and when we're looking at some of these, you know, risk behaviors, warning behaviors, precursors, absolutely. Domestic violence being one of them. Childhood exposure to violence, that's also seen as a risk factor that unfortunately continues on through adulthood.
Thanks for that call, Dennis, at 800-642-1234. I want to talk a little bit, Chris, about trends in mass shootings, mass violence episodes. We've seen a lot of them in the news, high-profile ones, but they are still rare. Most of us will go through life, knock on wood, without ever encountering such an event. Are we seeing more of them, though, over time?
You know, the answer is yes. The FBI did a study that was released in 2014 and looked at these incidents of active shooters between 2000 and 2013. Kind of the first half of the study, about 6 a year. The second half of the study, about 16 a year. So the short answer is, yes, they're increasing. But I think it's also important to view them in the context of, we have 12,000 homicides a year in the United States. So as a proportion of those, it's still a very small proportion.
And can we use similar tools of threat assessment, not just when we're talking about multiple attacks or mass violence, but for some of those individual acts?
Oh, absolutely. And there are a couple of different threat assessment tools that kind of, again, weigh out risk factors and things. And for domestic violence cases, they're very useful. So yes, they can.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Amelia is with us in Appleton. Hi.
I was wondering if you see in your studies that abusive animals like their own pets or other people's pets is a predictor of this behavior.
You know, I can't say specifically about pets, but that sort of getting good with being violent, absolutely, you know, either towards animals, towards other individuals. That's that novel aggression that I talked about. So again, not sure about specifically with pets, but absolutely individuals will kind of do some things to get used to the violence.
So it's kind of a ladder almost. They progress into bigger acts of violence.
Correct.
In many cases.
Correct.
Thanks for the call, Amelia. We're talking to Chris Cole, Director of Threat Intervention Services at UW-Madison's Police Department, also former FBI agent, looking at the idea of threat assessment. Back to your calls. Clayton is on the line in Eau Claire. Clayton, hi.
Hi there. I'm calling because I'm wondering what kind of predictive value this threat assessment really has. It just seems like, from the things that I've been hearing so far, that a lot of these things are things you find out after the fact or are difficult for small organizations to find out.
Well, raise a very good question. And first, obviously, after the facts come out, after an incident, when we go back and look at it, we're all geniuses picking things out then. And threat assessment, it's much more about prevention than prediction, if that makes sense. Again, things become very clear after the fact, but it's, again, trying to parse those out and then trying to prevent things from happening versus predicting them.
Clayton, thanks for that call. We'll go next to Lee on the line in Pewaukee. Lee, hi.
Hi. I just had a quick comment. I understand that there's a need for some of this you know, looking for certain behaviors in students. But I do caution, I get a little worried that, you know, teachers might try to peg a kid, or everything they see might they might think of as a threat when really it's not. And so I think that we really need to be careful, because that's a lot of power for school systems to have and these teachers. And they could really identify something incorrectly, and then all of a sudden you have a kid who's pegged who really there was no intention of anything there. So I think we just need to be careful of that.
And I would agree. And this, again, kind of goes back to instinct and intuition, too. If you've got a teacher that's been in the classroom for any length of time, they have a pretty good baseline as far as what's actually threatening and what's not.
Thanks for that call, Lee. But I wonder about, you know, we hear about implicit bias. If someone even unconsciously reads, does some profiling of their own without even thinking about it, thinking this ethnic group or what have you is more prone to violence, they might see this behavior threatening in that kid and the same behavior not in that other kid that doesn't fit their profile.
You know, and I think it's important to also point out that threat assessment is done as a team approach. And for instance, here at UW, it's not just the police department. It's our dean of students office. It's our university health services, university legal. So I think when you get multiple sets of eyes looking at an issue, that's a good way to kind of make sure we're not jumping to a conclusion. We're not letting biases set in.
Thanks a lot again for your call, Lee. So how can I think we come back to this smaller agency, an individual-owned business or something like that. How can they try to use some of the tools that you're using, as you say, as part of a team effort at that smaller scale?
You know, first is have a plan. There's a lot of information out there. Again, I mentioned ATAP, the Association of Threat Assessment Professionals. There's AS-IS, which is the Society of Industrial Security. There's a lot of good information out there and available to businesses that they can look at. And again, if they don't have the scale to have their own threat assessment team, there's a lot of good professionals out there. It's being pushed out to our local police departments. They're able to offer help.
And I know you do presentations. We saw one here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Is that something that maybe local police departments can do for the Chamber of Commerce or other small, groups of smaller?
Yes, certainly. And a lot of the training as a result of these mass shootings, there's been the, what to do if a shooter enters your building, the run, hide, fight. We want to get ahead of that. And I think the threat assessment training, getting that out there in a preventive mode, is just as important, in my view, if not more, than the what to do if it actually happens.
And you said important in your view. Are more people taking this idea seriously now?
Absolutely.
We'll leave it there. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Chris Cole. He was a former longtime FBI agent. He is now the Director of Threat Intervention Services at the UW-Madison Police Department. He joined us to talk about the idea of threat assessment. You can let us know over at the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Does your place of work have something like this in place? Do you do this? Have you reached out to maybe a local police department for information about threat assessment? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page.